One thing I have very little patience with is when jurisdictions and certain poll captains are issuing provisional ballots for practically for everybody when they might not have needed to. Remember, this is a fail-safe, not a backup plan. And if there's a way the voter couldn't be processed routinely, you need to make sure, as a poll worker, that every single bit of information on that provisional ballot envelope is filled out so that voter's vote does get counted. And it is the poll worker's responsibility to make sure that the voter is aware of what they need to fill out. Because if there's something missing, that can interfere with the adjudication.
You're entering the voting booth. I'm John Fortier of AEI.
And I'm Don Palmer with the Election Assistance Commission.
Welcome to the podcast that looks at the inner workings of elections.
With us today is Jenya Coulter. She is the Senior Director of Stakeholder Relations and Social Media and a Senior Election Analyst at the OSET Institute and the Trust the Vote Project. She's also appeared on their podcast regularly, Dead Man Don't Vote. And she's also done work with Elections Canada on various standards relating to voting technology. One of the reasons we really wanted Jenya on today is she has experience at the polling place level in Polk County, Florida, both recruiting poll workers, but also as precinct captain for 30 or so elections, knowing the insides and outs of that process. But even more than just the substantive knowledge, you may have run across Jenya before. And here I'm going to back up a little bit and talk about social media in a way that will, I think, embarrass me. I have a very boring Twitter handle. I'm John C. Fortier 1, just to distinguish me from all those other John C. Fortiers out there. Now, Mr. Palmer, my co-host, has a much more interesting one, The Voting Guy, where you can find him on X, Twitter. Jenya, many of you may know as Election Babe. So here I am, the plain vanilla with the Voting Guy and Election Babe. And she has been, of course, very active in explaining the election administration world to Twitter, to election Twitter and to others. And that's the reason why we really welcome her to the show today.
Well, welcome, Jenya. And John, we do love you. We really do. But welcome to the voting booth, Jenya. We appreciate you coming in to an actual voting booth. Talk to us a little bit about being a poll worker and a poll manager. You've been doing this for almost a decade, 30 plus elections, election after election. Maybe start talking about how you recruit and train them, which is probably the most important thing, and put the audience in the shoes of a poll worker when they're trying to get up to speed to actually facilitate an election.
Well, good morning, John. Good morning, Don. Thank you so much for having me. And thank you for putting me in a voting booth that I don't actually have to set up myself. You know, keeps my manicure nice. So anyway, yes, I was a poll worker for about 7 years, 30 elections. And it's certainly, you can never have too many poll workers. I mean, some jurisdictions might have that problem every general election, but for things like smaller municipal elections or for primaries, that's a little harder to achieve. And so, although I didn't do as much recruiting since I'm not necessarily a people person, but I am definitely one of the people who is great at explaining how you're supposed to properly set up and operate voting equipment, and also how to manage a crowd of 1,000 voters at, you know, 7 in the morning when most people haven't even had their coffee yet.
So Jenya, just following up on that, talk to us about how you trained folks that might be new and coming into the polling place to actually process voters.
One of the things that you learn about dealing with new poll workers or even poll workers who have been there for a while is that you can't meet them where you are. You have to meet them where they are. And sometimes that means adjusting your approach to having somebody who's, say, more a visual or kinesthetic learner. I'm extremely auditory. So if I hear something, I'll remember it. If you give me a visual aid, I probably won't pay that much attention, but most people are visual learners. So that was something that you have to adjust as you go along. And there's also, obviously, sometimes you run into things like technology gaps. I've had poll workers who have been incredibly experienced, who have had absolutely nothing but wonderful things said about them. This one of my favorites, she'd never operated a computer before in her entire life. And during COVID, we had to do training on the computer so we could, you know, minimize the spread. And I had to teach this very sweet lady about how to use a computer. And that was something that I've always taken for granted. I've never been in a time when there weren't computers. And so having to explain to somebody, you know, this is a cursor, this is a mouse, this is how you click here, this is how you save. It occurred to me how much I had taken that for granted because I'd always known it. And then, of course, you have, you know, new young poll workers who are coming in, and those are some of my favorites. And they are, you know, TikTok, Snapchat, everything, they're digital natives. But on the other hand, some of the things that we work with in elections, while they would be considered, you know, new technology, maybe not to some of the younger poll workers. I mean, it's at least some of the stuff's at least 10 years old or was designed 10 years ago. And so for them, they're just like, what is this? Especially the flip phone that we used to use at the precincts.
So put yourself in the shoes of a poll worker and just lay out a little bit the timeline for us. So you're a new poll worker. You're going to go through some training. When is that? How far in advance? I know this differs from state to state, but from your experience, how far in advance? How many hours are there? What kinds of things do you cover? So what's the role of a poll worker?
All right. So for poll workers, it depends on how much lead time you have before the election. And it also depends on how large your jurisdiction is and how many people they can spare from the office to do the training in the first place. Some places really do not have the luxury of being able to do training, you know, two months to 6 weeks prior to the election. And some, you know, other jurisdictions, particularly the larger, mid-sized to larger, can afford to have that lead time. And sometimes you can do all your training in person. When I first started, there was no computer training at all. It was, you came in and you sat there for, it was about 6 to 8 hours worth of training, at least for the position that I worked. Now, for the people who are check-in inspectors, obviously they have maybe 3 to 4 hours of training. But if you're in charge, you have to learn how to do every single position. Since you never know if somebody's going to, you know, may not be able to show up or have a family emergency.
So if we move from the initial contact and training of poll workers to the polling place, and you have experience managing and being part of running a polling place right at the voter level. So tell us a little bit of what goes into setting up that polling place from whatever needs to be done, from the equipment, from the recruiting to the planning, to the actual time when actual voting starts. Walk us through that process of what goes on to make that polling place ready to open on election day.
All right, the first part is acquiring the polling place, which is, I think, more complicated than people might realize. There are plenty of places that you would think would be perfect polling places. They're ADA compliant. They're in an area where people can easily access. And sometimes they don't want to be polling places. So you kind of have to love the one you're with and go and make that place ADA compliant and as accessible as humanly possible, although the facility itself is not really required to do anything. The responsibility for ADA compliance is on the election office and the poll workers at that place. And so you have to determine, okay, we need to make sure we have our eyes on everything at all times. How do we ensure that we don't miss any voters? How do we ensure smooth ingress and egress of traffic? And we also have to make sure that there's a circle of 5 feet around for anybody who might be in a wheelchair or a walker, so they can turn around without being impeded. And then we have to figure out, okay, so our voting booths, how many people do we think we're going to have? Sometimes you don't have enough voting booths. Other times you have far too many than you originally planned. And you want to make sure that there's plenty of space between those, so nobody's like, you know, voter privacy, nobody's staring at each other's ballots.
And what does it look like in the hour before the actual opening of the polling place?
I try to make sure my voting booths and everything were set up the day before. I don't know how anybody can get to the polling place and set up that morning. That would be my worst nightmare. I try to make sure that we are ready to go when it's 7 o'clock. The other thing that is something that has to be taken into consideration is you have to get there in time to have your equipment, if you use electronic poll books, and things like your ballot scanner or your ballot marking devices. You need to make sure that they've been warmed up. And in the case of the electronic poll book, they've properly synced with the central voter database in the county so that the county can monitor how many voters who's voted. And the polling place doesn't accidentally check a voter in at multiple locations.
So, Jenya, I'm going to follow up a little bit on this. I mean, reading your work, I get the impression that you really love your job when you were a poll manager. And talk to a little bit about managing an early voting site or a precinct polling place, and you know, how that worked during the course of Election Day.
I love early voting because it was one of those times where you can solve far more problems for voters than you can on Election Day. And you also have a little bit more space in which to do it. Election Day, there's so much pressure on people because it's that one day. You know, there are no do-overs. There are no, you know, if we can't fix something for you, then that's pretty much all we can do. Early voting, there's far more opportunities to be able to solve those issues. And with early voting, I mean, in my county, it's pretty much split. A third of our voters vote by mail. A third of our voters vote in person on Election Day. And a third take advantage of early voting. And we appreciate in that with early voting, you probably get better trained poll workers because they only select the people who've been doing this for a longer period. And it's also a bit, at least a few years ago, it was much more efficient check-in because we weren't having to deal with the old-fashioned paper poll books. We actually had our electronic poll books and we had scanners so we could scan ID. We didn't have to, you know, write down and inspect and go, is this correct? Can you fill in the oval right here? It's a lot, you know, it was far more efficient.
One of the things we talked about earlier was, what do you do when there's no guidance or a statute or regulation that tells you what to do as the election chief? And sometimes those situations arise. What do you do in that situation when it's your responsibility?
You take a deep breath, you smile, you call the hotline. And I really do hope that is something that has become more of a trend in American elections. If the election office does not have a hotline for the voters to call and ask the questions, like, you know, we just had, you know, there's a roaring lion outside the polling place. Can you please tell us how to proceed? If you don't have that, take a deep breath, smile, think about what you're going to tell the voter before you say it. Believe me, I've learned that one from experience. And you have to adjust accordingly. You also want to stay in close contact with the election office, so just in case there is a way that they can help or there is a remedy that they can offer. I mean, there are some situations that you are going to be able to address yourself. There are some situations that you really do need to let the election office take the lead because they know what they're doing. And then there are others that were so unexpected or out of the blue that you have to work in conjunction with both your voter and the election office in order to resolve.
All right, you need to give us an example of that. You're hinting that there have been some out of order things that have happened.
I had to explain to a voter that he was dead once. When he was very much alive. He was very much alive. What had happened was he was a junior. His father was a senior. And when his father died, the suffix senior had not been put in. And so this poor gentleman, everyone thought he was dead, and he was very much alive in front of me. That was a very interesting conversation with the election office. And unfortunately, because it was election day, there wasn't really much, they couldn't fix it. That had to get resolved, I think, for the next election. And the man had a great sense of humor about it. I appreciated how polite he was, but that was, you want an awkward situation that they do not tell you how to deal with in training? That has to be one of them.
Well, that was so hilarious. And you got to give us some more. Give us some more of these situations where the provisional ballot perhaps wouldn't work.
Well, actually, we did offer him the opportunity to vote via provisional. He elected not to. No pun intended. but now I haven't, honestly, one of the things that I know provisional ballots are extremely useful. I just feel my question about issuing a provisional is, was there a way that we could have found so the voter could have been processed routinely? And if we don't have to issue a provisional, if we can issue a regular ballot, I think that should be our optimum goal. But in the case of issuing provisionals, we did have a situation, unfortunately not as humorous, where there had been a group that was altering people's voter registrations when they would sign petitions outside of the tax collector's office. And they finally did catch the group that was responsible for doing this, and people, law enforcement, did deal with the situation. But we had this lovely voter who was blocked from voting in a primary because somebody had changed her registration. And that was a situation where I really did feel terrible because that voter had done nothing wrong. There was no control she had over the situation. Somebody took advantage of her trust, and I'm really glad that law enforcement was did eventually discover that this was going on. And the only reason I had had a reason to suspect that this was happening is because another voter had come in about an hour later, and she said, "Oh, you know, there's people who were making people sign petitions out in the parking lot." She said, "Some of them, somebody said that it looked like they had a voter registration form underneath the petition form." And once somebody has your signature, unfortunately, that's something that you do have to worry about. And Florida, I believe, had to adjust to that by cracking down on third-party voter registration groups. Now, a lot of people have said that that's horrible, that's voter disenfranchisement. It's also something that it was a situation that people were taking advantage of and needed to be addressed for the sake of election integrity and voter trust.
So I want to take us back to the timeline of how the election day or a day of early voting, whichever you want to say, proceeds. And you've talked about the opening of the polls and some of how the day works between the opening of the polls and the closing of the polls. So if you want to say more, anything about how it runs during the day, more want to hear that. But I wanted you to start focusing on the end of the day, getting close to the time where voting closes. What happens when the hour strikes, when the polls are technically closed? What happens with people in line? How you as election officials deal with these situations? And then the very important hour or hours, you tell us how much, after the closing of the polling place, all the things that you need to do before you go home for the evening.
Well, that's definitely the one of the things that I can see, the best advice I can give to anybody who is in charge of a polling place: get your paperwork organized and at least partially ready before the polling place opens, and make sure you do a reading of how many voters you've had and make sure that reconciles with the number of ballots you've got in your ballot scanner or that have been processed by the electronic voting machine, because it's a lot easier to fix something at 10 a.m. than it is at 6:30 p.m. when you've got half an hour left. Believe me, that will save you so much time and heartache. And the other thing is that when the last half hour, you have to make sure that everybody's, your poll workers are doing all right, they're sufficiently caffeinated, because yes, you have voters to process, but you also have, you have to make sure that the number of ballots you have is correct. You need to make sure everything balances. And so for that last 15 minutes of the polling place, I pretty much put myself at the desk, and unless it is an absolute emergency, I'm working on the paperwork. I'm making sure that on the worksheet that everything's syncing up. And then when the polling place closes, we can get everything filled out and put away, set up, packed up and put away. And we do not go over time. Now, if you have a line of 100 voters at that point, or your results aren't balancing properly, that's going to mean you're going to stay longer. And I have a personal vow to myself: I will never make my poll workers work later than they have to.
So give us a rough sense of the time. I know it can vary from election to election, but you know, first of all, are you announcing to the polling place you've got 10 minutes left, 5 minutes left, or time is up, but we're going to tell the people in line, of course, that they are allowed to vote. So give us a little sense of what you're saying to the voters, but then also, you know, give us a little sense of the amount of time from when you close to when you go home, especially if it's election night, the end of the election. And again, what you're all doing, what you and the other poll workers are doing in that period of time from when there's no more voting going on till you've sent off what you need to send off and you're ready to call it a night.
All right. Well, my poll deputy is the one who calls time. That is their responsibility. And my job is to tell them we've got 10 minutes left. We've got 5 minutes left. So they're the ones dealing with the voters, obviously, are, you know, the poll workers who are doing the check-ins. They understand that if somebody is waiting in line and they are in line at 7 p.m., they do get to vote, although we haven't really had that problem. One of the things that once the polls are closed, you have to start immediately making sure that everything balances, because your results have to be returned or transmitted to the election office by 7:20 p.m. And that is a hard deadline. There is, if you do not transmit your results, that is a major problem. And the election office will definitely be calling going, what's going on?
So election results have, you know, that's been sort of an issue recently, you know, the timeliness of them and the accuracy. You know, Florida's done a pretty good job, and there are some requirements in Florida and some policies that I think help there. You know, what do you think about, I mean, I think Florida's been a leader in getting those election results out to a public, both accurately and sort of timely. What do you say about that?
I think Florida does an exemplary job with this. And they've, I mean, since 2018 in particular, we've really turned the ship around and we are no longer a joke on election night. And that is one of the best compliments I think that the state and the supervisors of elections should all stand up and take a bow. They've done an amazing job. And yes, I do think that transmission, the policy of having everything transmitted by 7:20 p.m., that really does, I think as far as voter trust and confidence in our results, that does make a difference.
And I think that, you know, the pre-tabulation allows that to be extremely timely, particularly the early voting days and the vote by mail that has come in. So there are policies that can help get those results out in a more timely manner. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely. Being able to pre-process ballots and also making sure that you have your early voting results, although they cannot break those down by precinct because of how the tabulators get set up, they can at least get a general total. And then you can figure out the fine details later.
And I think voter confidence, I mean, in the end, it really does improve voter confidence. We all want to make sure we get the results out accurately and timely. It's a sort of a secondary, but it does impact and improve voter confidence. Would you agree with that?
Absolutely.
Yeah. I want to talk a little bit about the Presidential Commission on Election Administration. You know, we both worked on in the aftermath of that report that came out after the 2012 election. And one of the issues were lines that might form and congestion at the polling place. Jenny, can you talk to us a little bit about your issues with how you manage your polling place to sort of minimize the impact of lines and how you dealt with the sort of voting technology that in sometimes is antiquated that you have to work with?
Now, I had a poll deputy. I was blessed. He passed away last year. God rest his soul. Everything I know about line management, I learned from Daryl. And Daryl had been a former NYPD cop. And so he knew how to deal with crowds. He was very good at engaging with them, explaining to them where they needed to go, what they needed to have out. And he also had a hard rule. Nobody lines up at the door prior to 6:30. Because, you know, you've seen this on Black Friday. People will line up at like 4 in the morning and the store's not going to open until 6. You will never get that line down. You have to limit when people are allowed to begin lining up, and then it's manageable and you have the line knocked out, and by the time you're in normal operations, there's no line. And that is a secret I do wish that more poll workers were made aware of, is you have to limit the early line so you don't have a much longer line later in the day that you'll never be able to catch up with.
Do you have ways in which you measure how many people are in line or the length of time at a certain time across the day? That was one of the things with the PCA and some work we did with MIT and Charles Stewart to try to get places to measure their polls more accurately as to how long lines are. What was your guide for whether you were getting too long or where you were in the process?
I tried to take averages. What I would do is I'd have my deputy give a voter a card, and then when they came up, and I'd have him mark down the time. And when that voter came up to us and I would check the time, I think the longest anybody has ever had to wait at any of my polling places, even at full capacity, was 14 minutes. And that is, I'm very proud of that because I understand that I live in an area where there's a lot of elderly voters, and there's also a high proportion of voters who use mobility devices. I don't want them to have to wait in line any longer than is absolutely necessary. And I had to explain to my check-in specialist, you know, I know you want to catch up with people because they're your friends, they're your neighbors, but we have to be efficient here because I don't want anybody, every minute we spend talking is a minute that we're not spent processing. So although you might not get as personal of an experience, you are getting done a lot faster because I've seen conversations go on for 5 minutes. There's a line of 20 people. It's like, we can't let that happen. We have to focus on everybody, not just the individual.
So I want to focus on one other aspect of the voting day, and that is, you know, you are an election official and the poll workers are even those who are there just for a day, they're election officials working for the for the locality, working for the official running of the election. But there are also observers. Often they're party observers, the Republicans, the Democrats, or other third parties. Sometimes polling places allow other types of observers. They've been in the news recently. Some question about what's the right role of these observers. Are they too zealous? Are they trying to push for things that's beyond their role? Occasionally you hear about the opposite, places that have a hard time getting observers there or getting a Republican or getting a Democrat because it's overwhelmed. So what would you say about the role of them and your role in running a polling place? How do you interact with that? And if I might, I know we talked a little bit offline of this, but I think you talked about yourself as the alpha polling clerk in some way. So maybe I'm using the wrong term, but how do you, as someone who's in charge of the polling place, deal with these observers who are there to watch the election in various respects?
Well, to be perfectly honest, they have the right to be there. They are observing our democratic process. And I'm happy to see poll watchers for the most part, because they are making sure that we are doing our job and serving our voters well and complying with the law. We cannot have observers interfering with the process, because that's not what they're there for. Our job is to process, their job is to observe. When I encounter a poll watcher, I'm always polite, I'm always happy to see them. And it's just sometimes you have to establish dominance. You know, good morning, welcome to our polling place. Please direct any questions that you may have to me. Here's the general rules. You may not interact with the voters. You may not interact with my workers. I am who you speak with. And if you have any concerns, please bring them up to me. And if you have to make a phone call, please go outside, because we don't, you know, for the sake of, it's a small place. When you're talking on the phone, we can't hear our voters. And just indirect, deal with them at their level. And don't, you know, there's certainly no reason to be rude or being dismissive, because again, they have the right to be there. And eventually the poll watchers, you get to know them. And I mean, I spent one year, I spent more time with them than I probably did my kids. And I enjoy, I mean, it's like I wound up thinking, wow, do I owe them a Christmas card this year?
Have you ever had an incident where, you know, they questioned, you know, the process that was going on in the polling place, and are you following, you know, Florida rules, and how did you address that issue? Because occasionally, you know, that occurs.
Oh, I absolutely had that problem. That was, I think this is back in 2018. And I had a very lovely poll watcher who was insisting that I had to issue a provisional ballot. And I was well aware via training that no, I was actually able to process this voter routinely. And she was not very pleased with me. And I said, I'm more than happy to call the election office. And she's like, I would prefer you do that. She was an attorney, apparently, in her day job. So, I mean, I should have known that I walked into that one. And our supervisor of elections, wonderful, wonderful professional administrator that she is, actually came to our polling place and explained to the poll watcher that no, I did not need to issue a provisional ballot. I was in complete compliance with the law. And I looked at the poll watcher and I smiled and I said, well, I think she has the final say on this one. And I think she actually stayed to observe for another week of early voting. But I think that was one of my more interesting poll watcher stories. I wanted to stick my tongue out and go, see, I was right, but you know, I'm not for.
Yeah, in my experience, sometimes what is permissible from a First Amendment perspective is somewhat of an issue from a legal perspective. And poll watchers sometimes want to talk to voters or talk to workers. And that was always a struggle that I had, was sort of trying to tamp that down.
Well, that's why you have to establish the rules up front. And if there is a transgression, you just have to politely take them aside and go, I'm really sorry, but you know, we did explain the rules. Unfortunately, we are not allowed to have you speak with the voters, at least not within however many feet of the polling place.
So I want to shift a little bit to how you deal with problems. You talked a little bit about issues that occasionally will happen with voters or poll watchers, but let's talk about what happens when the technology breaks down or there's a snafu with it, or even worse, there's flooding or a hurricane that sort of impacts the voting process. How do you deal with those issues?
You smile, you take a deep breath, and you troubleshoot. Of course, in conjunction with the election technology department, if your jurisdiction has one. And with certain things, sometimes it's as simple as your printer's out of paper or you need a new toner cartridge. Other times your machine is possessed by an evil demon and the best thing you can do is just pray to the gods that it works. We actually had in my first election was Trial by Fire. We had a ballot scanner that would not work for this one particular voter. And so he came back. Ballot scanner which had worked all day, it would not work for him. And I do not know what had happened with that. Fortunately, the next year we got new scanners and I've never had that problem since.
But at the end of the day, you do have a paper ballot there. So it's,
yes.
we're not saying that this voter's vote wasn't counted. It's just, it couldn't go through the technology at that time.
I'm amazed. I think he needed a tiny crowbar to pry his fingers off of the chair. I still feel bad about that, but his vote did get counted. It's just, it had to be adjudicated manually. And as far as natural disasters and hurricanes, there's not a lot of control you have over Mother Nature. You have to just smile, take a deep breath. And if you have an alternate plan, that's a great time to get one started. And when you're dealing with things such as, you know, a hurricane that might knock out however many polling places you typically use, this is where the election office has to consider their alternatives. And also the Secretary of State and the governor can be incredibly helpful in helping your local election administrators determine, are there areas where we can make vote by mail more accessible for those voters? Is there a way that we can go on local news and explain to voters, here are your options for those of you who have been impacted by this event? You know, we promise we are open for business and we will meet you where you are.
And maybe I could take you back just to one thing that you've touched on a little before, and that some snafus with voters, they don't show up on the registration list, or perhaps there's an ID issue. There is the possibility, it's in federal law, and states have other options for it, for a provisional ballot. And again, I think most of our listeners would know what that is, but hopefully most of them have not had to cast one. So just, a simple point is that's a ballot that you cast, even though there might be some seeming problem with you being able to vote. It's put in an envelope and it's adjudicated later. Are you actually registered? We'll figure it out. We'll count that vote or not. And I think it was interesting to hear you say that you'd like to resolve problems without having to have a voter do that. But it is there as part of the process. So maybe talk a little bit about that as a process, how it works, how voters feel about you giving them a provisional ballot. And at the end of the day, just does it take longer? What would you say about this provisional ballot process, which is a fail-safe? It's not supposed to be for the regular voter, but it is there for problems that poll managers have to utilize at some point.
Okay, provisional ballots are an amazing fail-safe, and yet you are 100% correct there. One thing I have very little patience with is when jurisdictions and certain poll captains are issuing provisional ballots for everybody when they might not have needed to. Remember, this is a fail-safe, not a backup plan. And if there's a way the voter couldn't be processed routinely, you need to make sure as a poll worker that every single bit of information on that provisional ballot envelope is filled out so that voter's vote does get counted. And it is the poll worker's responsibility to make sure that the voter is aware of what they need to fill out. Because if there's something missing, that can interfere with the adjudication. So when a voter is issued a provisional ballot, we very politely explain, look, we just have to add an extra step into your process. Nothing's wrong. We just need to make sure that everything's correct with your record. And we just have to have you fill out this envelope and you're going to vote a regular ballot. And then you are going to place it in this envelope. And we are going to deliver this directly to the election office at the end of the night.
How do those conversations go? I mean, I'm sure they go different ways, but how do voters react?
Overall, they react pretty well. I haven't had too many issues with people complaining about a provisional ballot. I think there's been some voters who were surprised by it. But when they understand that ballot goes directly to the election office and it's going to be examined by humans, they realize, okay, it's going to be fine. And we always make sure that they know there's a number you can call. This is your tracking number. You can call the office and give them that tracking number within the next couple of days, and they can tell you the status of your ballot. And I think voters appreciate that peace of mind.
I have a question about, you mentioned that you did some work on some Canadian standards for electronic poll books. And that was of note to me. It's of interest because the EAC is finalizing those and launching a testing program. Could you talk a little bit about EPP standards? You know, just summarize for the audience what you think's important to be in those standards.
And if I could stress that, again, I think most of our listeners know what an EPB or an electronic poll book is, but just step back a bit that when you're checking in to be registered, someone may have a tablet with the registration system on it. Give this information about these devices from a non-technical perspective as well as what you're doing with standards.
All right. So electronic poll books are a really nice tool to have at the polling place. They have the record of your voters in your jurisdiction, and or at least for your precinct. And what they do is they can communicate with the, either they can be standalone or they'll communicate with the election office, and they let you know which voter is in front of you and if they need to make any changes to their record. That's really nice because that also saves us from having to issue a provisional. If somebody's moved or they've changed their name, we can correct their record in real time, which really appreciate it. So once you've checked in, the election office knows that the voter has also been checked in and you issue your ballot. And then we can just check them off the list. And if they accidentally go to a different polling place, then they can go, oh, you know, you've already voted. You're good. And it's also a very nice way to verify ID because we have the scanners.
So you did some work, sort of what sort of standards should be a part of that. What was your input and what are your thoughts on standards for electronic poll books?
Electronic poll books in some ways do a great job at what they do. I think that part of the issue is if you're running electronic poll books on a system that's heading towards end of life, that is obviously that could be a problem because you'll get these unexpected glitches and nobody's quite sure what to do with them. It's just the system's aging. You want to make sure with these systems and electronic poll books, you can't have a lot of downtime because if it takes a long time to sync up because you've got voters you have to process. I believe there's a county in California that had problems with the electronic poll books properly communicating with the back office because of a syncing issue. And that's something that you really have to iron out as quickly as you can. So you want maximum uptime as far as your system. You want an interface that is intuitive because not everybody is super tech savvy. You want to make sure that your poll worker understands which buttons do what, which buttons they should not under any circumstances touch and minimize those if possible. And also you need to make sure that the voter is aware of what they will need to do on this particular piece of equipment. Will they need to sign? Will they need to use their finger? Will they need to use a stylus? Make sure you have styluses. And you want to make sure that your signature capture, because this is going to cause problems later, you want a relatively accurate signature capture, because if it looks like a mess, people are going to dispute the validity of that voter later on, as we've seen with certain audits in other places.
And I want to remind our listeners that we had an earlier episode with one of Don Palmer's colleagues on the Election Assistance Commission, Commissioner Christy McCormick, where we discussed at least the Election Assistance Commission's new effort to begin the certification testing of types of technology that are not the voting machines, not the voting technology directly, but the related things like e-poll books. So what you're doing with Canada and what the EAC is doing with America is actually the coming thing where we're really trying to bring technology of all sorts up to some standards that people can trust. So with that, we could probably talk about the polling place for a very long time. The polling place is open for, depending on the state, 8, 10, 12 hours a day. But we've come to the end of our time, but we do ask two questions of our guests, the same ones each time. And I'm going to begin and ask you, so Jenya, how did you get into election administration? What was your path there? And now that you know a lot, you're experienced, what would you tell your pre-election self? What would you tell yourself that didn't know all that you know now about elections?
I got into elections almost on a fluke. When I moved to Florida, I was getting my driver's license, and there was a thing on the driver's license form, would you be interested in being a poll worker? So I checked the box, didn't think anything of it. And I remember one morning, this absolutely adorable kitten ran into the house, and my husband was like, well, can I keep him? And so that was how we got our cat Roscoe. And that day, a letter from the election office came saying that they needed poll workers. And that was literally how I got my start. And as far as what I would tell, what I would tell myself, you don't have to be as much of a control freak. And the other thing is, be better at making small talk, because apparently, although I'm great with machines, I'm not necessarily as good with people. And machines are not who you have to worry about being happy with you at the end of the night. It's your voters.
So, Jenya, you've been, as you mentioned, you've been involved in elections for over a decade, been a poll worker a long time. What's a funny or notable experience that you have experienced in that time that you would share with the listeners?
One of the funniest things, I think, was the time that a facility that had been a longtime polling place decided one year they didn't want to be a polling place for early voting. And they put us, so we got put in the Phosphate Museum, which was a converted railway car in Florida in August with no air conditioning. It was great if you were, I mean, it was great if you're doing a sardine impression. But one of the things that we had, that our, my polling deputy, she was a very brave, intrepid woman. She noticed that our former polling place was right across the street. And she went over there and there were things, there was nothing going on. And they had said that they had this huge event they couldn't possibly be as a polling place. And we realized that that place had misrepresented the level of availability that they'd had to our supervisor of elections.
Well, Jenya, thank you for joining us. But I do want to remind viewers that I, the exciting John C. 40A1 Twitter handle, the more exciting at voting guy, Don Palmer, and you, Jenya Coulter, election babe, thank you for joining us in the voting booth.
Thank you.
Thank you. I had a great time, and thank you so much for asking me.
Thank you for listening to The Voting Booth, a podcast of the American Enterprise Institute. This program was produced by Jay Humbley and hosted by John Fortier and Don Palmer. If you enjoyed this episode, we encourage you to subscribe to The Voting Booth wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks again for listening, and tune in next time.